You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you have been listening to and enjoying our podcast, please help out the show by leaving us a 5-star rating on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, as always in the beginning here, I'd like to invite you to join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. So this week, we only have one email to answer, and I'll get to that in just a second, but I want to take this time I have here to address something else real quick. I've been asked on multiple occasions recently about photos floating around various social media sites of what people claim is the actual, the real 90-foot stone. And I mean a few different photos, not just one. And obviously that means a few different stones as well, and they're all being offered up as the real, genuine 90-foot stone found in the money pit in 1804. Now, I don't want to address any specific stone of the ones I've seen, and I certainly can't say that I'm an expert here on whether or not this is genuine or not. And like I said, there's many out there, so I don't want to just focus on one. I've recently seen most of these before now, but for some reason they're making the rounds of the internet again recently, probably just due to the popularity of the show and it being in mid-season and all that. But let me just say this to everyone who asked me about these particular things and to anyone wondering about them out there. And this applies to almost any such evidence you might see online, not just these stones. Always ask questions. Always dig as deep as you possibly can before passing any judgment, pro or con. And if those questions that you ask can't, or for some reason won't be answered for whatever reason, by the person who is trying to present this evidence as the truth, assume if they can't answer those questions, that the real honest answers to them would only serve to lessen the evidence's credibility. Does that make sense? Now, with the 90-foot stone in particular, any evidence as to the credibility of any artifact offered up anywhere, as the genuine thing, has problems that are just simply inherent in the whole idea of someone coming into possession of the stone. For instance, no one in the history of the stone's existence, in air quotes, ever took a photo or an etching of the actual stone itself when they had it. When the stone was first pulled out of the money pit in 1804, no one from the Onslow Company, the people who found it, or anyone else for that matter, bothered to copy it down or sketch it, or trace it, or etch it, or anything like that. In fact, there's not even a mention of the 90-foot stone in any real Oak Island records until the 1860s. So really, there's no definitive way to verify any claims of the stone, but the only really effective methods to do so by comparing it to, you know, what we think is a historically accurate photo or etching or copy. So for all intents and purposes, really, I can make a stone myself out of my garage and then go around the internet with photos telling everyone it's the real thing. And there's really literally no way for anyone to factually dispute that if that's the sum total of what I have to present to you. And even if we accept the stone's existence, which some people don't, by the way, and even if we accept the most often used description of the stone as true, the one you see mostly depicted in the show, that's also disputed, by the way, then the stone itself, the real thing, has already all but been destroyed. It was used in a fireplace for decades at a time when that fireplace was its home's only source of heat, so used quite a bit, and then later had the hell beaten out of it by a bookbinder. And that's just two examples among others. So in order to accept that the stone, that any stone that you see that's clean and has all the markings still on it, in order to accept that, we would have to therefore accept a totally different history of this stone's existence over the last 2+ centuries from the one we have some records of from 1860 and on. We have to accept that all the reports and all the claims up until now are then fake. So any backstory for a new stone would then need to be independently verified. And if the person presenting the stone can't, or more often won't, verify that entire story, the entire 215 years of it, then how could we conclude the stone they are presenting to us is anything near the genuine article? Put simply, we can't. Or at least I can't make such a conclusion. The most popular story I hear here is the, quote, "I got it from somebody who worked on the island way back when" line. It comes up a lot for a lot of things. Well, who? When? If you can't tell me that information, why not? And does that really pass the smell test? Let's be honest. For instance, if we're talking about the 90-foot stone in particular, the person who's the source of this find would have to be someone who worked on the island at least as far back as, you know, probably before the 1930s. Because from that point on, we really have good documentation from the guys who ran the search, people like the Chapels, the Restalls, Hedden, Blankenship, and all the others you've heard of. So that's almost 100 years ago. And if they claim they have some reason why they simply must stay anonymous, then you really have to question the validity of just that reason. None of those guys I mentioned, nor the people who worked with them, would have hidden the stone if they had indeed found it. They simply have no good reason that I can think of. Hey, email me if I'm wrong. They had no good reason to do that. Finding and displaying the famed 90-foot stone of the Money Pit in Oak Island could only help their cause. It could only help to raise money and interest in the dig, in their project. The justification I see most for not revealing all is to somehow blame Prometheus for why they have to be cagey, you know? The greedy big Hollywood corporation makes a good target here. This works even better for them since Prometheus won't probably ever bother to defend themselves in public against all the dozens and dozens of claims and conspiracies they face all the time. It's a convenient out. But again, it just doesn't pass the smell test with me. Listen, folks, people have been trying to inject themselves into the Oak Island story for centuries. People have wanted to become part of the search, part of the hype, really, and have been claiming that this or that or the other thing or, you know, whatever it is that they have or claim to have. They've been doing this for as long as this thing has been going on. Let's be honest. Remember, even last season, the team found what they eventually determined was a fake 90-foot stone. I've mentioned this a bunch of times before. So this kind of stuff happens all the time and will continue to happen for as long as the search goes on, especially as long as it remains popular, and it is more popular and more known now than it has ever been in its history. Until I hear a truly verifiable story, until I see dating and other testing done on whatever you're presenting, or even some good corroborating historical evidence to back it up, I'm always going to be skeptical of these things, especially of stuff I find on the internet. But these things are always fun to talk about, so don't be afraid to keep on asking. Okay, so let's get to this week's email, which was sent in by a listener named Paul. He writes, "My question is, if it's theorized that the Templars were the original depositors and the island itself was in their control and ownership after depositing the treasure, why wouldn't they simply retain ownership and set up a farm to keep other people away? It seems they either had no further use for the island due to relocating the treasure or something happened out of their control to have them relinquish their ownership. What are your thoughts?" Paul, this is a great question, and it gets to the heart of something that really annoys the heck out of me, honestly, with the show. So many times when the idea of the Knights Templar is brought up, especially by the narrator, they're so quick to mess with the timeline of their real history that it's honestly ridiculous and frustrating, and like I said, irresponsible. The Knights Templar were in existence from 1119 until they were officially dissolved by the Pope in 1312. Now, sure, some knights survived the purge along with other Templar-related organizations for some time after 1312. But those were not the Knights Templar. Again, there might be some family connections within these later organizations to actual men who served as Templars or some other tangential connection, but that's it. They're not Templars. Templars are Templars, and they only existed until the early 14th century. They're not Freemasons. They're not Rosicrucians. They are the Knights Templar. So if a group of Templars sailed across the Atlantic and were actually on Oak Island, then it would have had to have been at least 180 years or so before Columbus arrived, and at the latest, and 185 years, therefore, then before John Cabot ever drew the first map of what is now the Atlantic coast of Canada. The first official settlement by Europeans of Nova Scotia was by the French, and that didn't happen until 1605. which again, it's almost 300 years later. So the point is, the Templars would have no way or reason to establish ownership if they did this, unless they were there to claim the land for the Vatican or something like that, I guess, but that obviously never happened. They never settled in Nova Scotia, so to speak, so there would have been no reason for them to make a land claim. Am I making sense here to you, Paul? If the Templars were on Oak Island, we would be talking about a time when no one in Europe, except maybe the Vikings, I guess, would have even accepted the very existence of North America as a fact. And if they did sail to Nova Scotia, they obviously wanted to keep that voyage a very well-guarded secret for whatever reason. This is where the whole idea of hiding treasure or religious artifacts, or maybe, I guess, escaping persecution, simply has to come into play in this story and then become the driving reason for any such Templar voyage to North America. The Templars would have had to sail for months into the unknown, carrying their most precious cargo, and then tell absolutely no one about it afterwards. Not a king, not the Pope and the Vatican, not their families, and probably not also many other Templars as well. So we can imagine they would have had a very good reason for that, a reason that required absolute secrecy. So then therefore the idea of discovering a new world or establishing a foothold in that world just wasn't in the cards for whatever they were doing here. Now, the Templars were certainly a secretive bunch, to say the least. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they wrote down pretty much nothing. We have almost no records of any kind that come directly from the Templars themselves. It's incredible, really, when you think about it and consider how important the Templars were to the financial and political world of Europe in their time. They're probably the most important organization in all of Europe during their existence. So I can certainly see this happening, the secretiveness, I mean, and that they could have pulled it off, probably, and you know they apparently pulled off a lot of other such stuff. But that then eliminates any desire on their part for something akin to ownership of land in Atlantic Canada. Now, I hope that makes sense, Paul. The problem for many viewers who may not know all that much about the real life and times of the Knights Templar, and let me stress here, I'm no expert, don't get me wrong, I'm a podcaster, but the problem is the narrator on the show always seems to connect events that happened centuries after the Templars were disbanded back to the Knights themselves, as if the Knights themselves were there for all this. And they almost always do this by essentially equating other secretive organizations like the aforementioned Freemasons or the Rosicrucians or many others. They equate them with the Templars themselves. And to me, that, again, is just irresponsible on their part, and it drives me nuts. Those organizations I mentioned didn't come into existence until hundreds of years after the Templars were disbanded. Hundreds of years. Sure, you might find, again, a family relation or some, you know, or something like that if you dig deep into it. And many of these organizations appear to have taken some inspiration from the rituals and the practices of the Templars. But is that enough to call someone in the 16th century a Templar? Or the 17th century even? Or even related to the Templars? I'm sorry, it's just not to me. What I would recommend is a bit of a shameless plug here. Go back to my podcast from October 7th and 10th of 2019. It's a two-part interview with Templar historian, the fascinating Tony McMahon. It's great to listen to. It's a good way to get a nice primer on the Templars and really what they were all about. Thanks, Paul, for the great email. If you, too, would like to email me and have your question answered on a future podcast, just send it to digginoakisland@gmail.com. So let's get into this week's episode of The Curse of Oak Island, entitled this week, The Turning Point. It begins with Vanessa Lucido and her crew coming across the causeway, towing some pretty impressive-looking gear. Lucido is the CEO and owner of the Salt Lake City, Utah-based company Rock Equipment Limited, I think, that specializes in large equipment, large digging and drilling equipment, exactly what the Laginas need here on Oak Island. We've seen her before in past seasons, I think since season four, actually. She really is an expert on all this, and if you go on her company's website, they have some great photo galleries up of pictures of the work they've done in, you know, and over the past couple of years. It might be a good resource moving ahead of, you know, to compare things that have changed with her work and how this work just really keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Take a look. Rock Equipment is bringing in what they call 8-foot cans. It's a huge 8-foot wide steel tubes, which they will then twist and turn into the ground. While this is happening, they also empty the dirt inside the cans and anything that might also be in there with this incredibly manly looking and manly named tool called a hammer grab. Lucido says the first can, the starter can, I think is what she calls it, weighs 54,000 pounds. Unbelievable. And they have enough cans to get them down to a depth of 200 feet or so. The amazing thing with this method is that even if it fills with water from the booby trap or flood tunnels or whatever, you can essentially send a diver down safely into these cans to then have a look. Something done before many times. It creates a good solid wall as opposed to the potential, you know, collapsing of what is a normal dirt shaft. Now, the real pioneer in this whole idea was the late Dan Blankenship. In the 1970s, Blankenship was drilling exploratory holes in an area just a few hundred yards to the northeast of the Money Pit. In one of these holes, a hole he labeled 10X, Dan found metal fragments in the core samples and even some evidence of an underground cavern down there of some kind. Thus, Blankenship and his team, which included his son Dave and also Dan Henske, who you see in this episode, began a project of expanding the hole and searching down there, even diving down himself into 10X. It was a project that lasted for years and years. Dan sent cameras down to look around, and like I said, even dove down to the bottom of the hole himself. And in that, throughout that searching, they found what he thought was like a wooden box, maybe a dead body lying on the ground. There was even at one point what he thought was a severed hand floating by the camera lens. In 1976, while down in 10X, the shaft he built began to collapse around him. But his son Dave luckily pulled him out of there just in the nick of time. I mean, Dan was literally seconds away from becoming the seventh victim of the Oak Island search. But simply coming within a whisper of death wasn't really enough to discourage the indomitable Dan Blankenship from getting to the truth of what might be down there. So Dan and his crew began to redig 10X, and in an attempt to stabilize his new shaft and make it safer for further exploration, the team procured a couple of old railroad tank cars and then lowered, using a crane, lowered them down into this hole. It was the first ever can, in air quotes, to be shoved into the ground in Oak Island, the first of many to come. Dan was nothing if he wasn't determined and inventive. If I'm not mistaken, the tanker cars are still in the ground to this day. Vanessa Lucido makes the funny yet somewhat sobering comment that this project, the project of shoving 200 feet worth of 8-foot wide tubes down into the ground with the goal of looking for treasure, is obviously nothing like anything her company has ever done. That's not a shock, but it also doesn't seem to discourage her at all from the idea of continuing. The episode ends with Vanessa Lucido directing Dave Blankenship and Dan Henske to press the start button on the giant oscillator and thus begin this project. A project which, honestly, is nothing short of the biggest and best attempt at the Money Pit anyone has taken in the easily over 100 years since the real location of the Money Pit, the first location of the Money Pit, was lost to time. In the coming weeks, we're going to see just how close the Laginas actually are to finding the original Money Pit. So here we go, kids. Hopefully Prometheus has saved the best of this season for last. So let's take a quick stop at a fascinating location. And honestly, I was not expecting to see this location this season. I'm talking about Lot 25. It's the location of the former home of Samuel Ball. So who was Samuel Ball and why would his home be important to the treasure hunt? I've discussed this and outlined this before, but let's just do it again here for people who might not have been listening since the very early days of this podcast. Now, Samuel Ball is perhaps the most enigmatic figure in the early history of the Oak Island treasure hunt, if not the entire history. It's very possible, and maybe almost likely, that Samuel Ball played a huge part in the first few decades of the Money Pit mystery. The problem is, we have almost no earthly idea what exactly that part just might have been, and certainly no records of it to reference and try to figure out now. So, Samuel Ball was born a slave in South Carolina in November of 1765. Shortly following the start of the American Revolution, for those who don't remember their eighth grade history, James Murray, who was the fourth Earl of Dunmar and then the governor of the colony of Virginia, the Loyalist governor, the British governor, issued a proclamation which offered freedom to any slaves who would leave their American owners in exchange for them joining the British army and fighting against the colonists. So Ball took up that offer and fled his captives in South Carolina to join up with the British Army and the Loyalist cause. In his years of service, Ball served under Generals Cornwallis and Henry Clinton in what was essentially non-combat roles, I guess, since he was really just a child. After the war, as a young adult now, he was among the many Loyalists who fled the United States, the new United States, for Nova Scotia to try and start a new life. In 1787, the age of all of 23, Ball purchased his first lot on Oak Island for the rather extraordinary cost at the time of £8 sterling, much more than other comparable properties in the area were selling for. Why was this small lot on Oak Island worth so much even 8 years before the discovery of the money pit? Well, that's a very good question and one that we don't have an answer for. The theory, though, is, if we're going to go into theories, is that Ball was friends with Daniel McGinnis before coming there. McGinnis was also a former Loyalist fighter in the Revolution, and by 1787, he was also an Oak Island landowner himself. We know McGinnis and Ball were certainly friends later in life, but it is possible they were partners in all this from the very beginning. Maybe even as early as 1787, McGinnis knew what he was looking for, or that he was indeed looking for something on Oak Island. It seems plausible enough to me, but like I said, we have nothing in the way of records or research to guide us here. And this is another one of those things. I mentioned this earlier. Our author James McQuiston brought this up in a recent War Room session of the possibility that the original discoverers of the money pit didn't just discover it on accident, right? They had some idea that they were looking for something, and this is just another kind of little piece of evidence for that. What we do know is that Samuel Ball went on to own multiple expensive lots on Oak Island, over 100 acres on the mainland as well, and he even purchased his own island called Hook Island, now appropriately named Sam's Island, and that he purchased from a man named Daniel Vaughan in 1790, and you guessed it, that's the very same Vaughan family. That also includes one Anthony Vaughan, another of the discoverers of the money pit. So needless to say, Ball was very well connected. Very well connected to all these events and all these people surrounding the early history of the money pit. But for some reason, his name is all but left out of the record. The part of all this that bugs me, though, really, is the idea, the conclusion then, that Ball must have found the treasure. I mean, how else could he have gotten so rich? But really, I think that's doing the man a great injustice just to assume that with no real evidence. Samuel Ball, the former slave who fled his home as a 10-year-old boy, did indeed do very well for himself in life. He was, for all we know, nothing more than a farmer, and maybe even worked as a fisherman or was involved in the logging business somehow. While his wealth certainly adds to the lore and mystery of Oak Island, and also to the enigmatic quality of the man himself, it might also be that Samuel Ball was just a really smart, motivated, and hardworking guy who made the best out of what was undoubtedly a difficult situation. I'll say this, though. I don't know how Samuel Ball got so rich, and I have no idea how much he was actually involved with the discoveries of the money pit and the first attempts at digging for treasure. But what I do know is that no one else knows that either. So any chance to find some clues or some insight into his life and his years on Oak Island is truly exciting stuff for an Oak Island fan like me. And it's obviously exciting to Laird Niven and the Laginas, too, as they begin here a new search around what is left of his former home. Now, Samuel Ball's house, like I said, was located on Lot 25, which is on the southern shore of the island, just about in the center of what the team calls the Western Drumlin, the side of the island to the left of the swamp, if you're looking at a map. Like the McGinnis homestead, all that's left today is a weather-beaten stone foundation. And also like the McGinnis homestead, it is protected by the Canadian government as a historical site, so therefore the Laginas can't simply go at it with an excavator and a bulldozer. That's where Laird Niven comes in, the government-approved archaeologist in all this. Just like Niven's project over at the McGinnis location, which we saw just some of last week, actually, he's attempting here, through what he's doing, to gather clues clues that might help to convince the government to then therefore approve a new permit, which would allow for further and more exhaustive digging and excavation of the site. So, to that end, ground-penetrating radar experts Steve Watson and Don Johnston, I think is his name, are back on Oak Island. I've seen him a couple times. This time, they're there to do a scan of what appears to be the entire Ball property. Watson and Johnston find what they call an anomaly. There's that frustrating word again. This anomaly seems to have six-foot walls, making it appear like a hidden cellar or maybe a vault or that kind of thing. And honestly, I was stunned to hear Laird refer to it as a treasure chest anomaly, in quotes, when talking about it. That's quite the leap for the normally reserved and, you know, really rather clinical Niven. But here again, not much is going to come of this project anytime soon. And I know that can be frustrating for many viewers, myself included. The guys come in, they do this scan, they find tantalizing yet painfully nonspecific evidence, and then the whole project is just sort of put on the back burner for the foreseeable future. Now, here they have good reason for shelving the project, considering it's really against the law to do anything more than what they've already done. So let's hope in a future show, maybe even a future season, we can come back to this project and learn more about the elusive Samuel Ball. And now let's finish off over at the Swamp. And what a season it has been at the Swamp so far. Work being done here is really fascinating stuff. And I've said this before, because this is relatively new ground for the Oak Island mystery. Before Fred Nolan, no one really paid any attention to the Swamp. It was not at all part of the mystery or of the greater search. I think that's important to keep in mind sometimes. In the 200-plus year history of the Oak Island treasure hunt, the Swamp has only really been part of the equation for maybe like the last 50 years or so. And much of that work, done before the Laginas arrived on the scene, was conducted really behind closed doors, so to speak, as Fred Nolan didn't really let anyone besides himself do any looking around in the area. Now, that fact can be good and bad, the fact that this is only 50 years old or so. The bad is the obvious question of why not? Why not look here? Why was the Swamp ignored by the 160-plus years of treasure hunters when it's really right there, right next to the money pit? Now, that's something worth thinking about for sure, and one, you know, we don't really have an answer for. But the good part in all this, however, is that the Swamp is almost entirely devoid of any searcher footprints left behind. The problem literally everywhere else in the island, like Smith's Cove, the Money Pit, and even the Uplands area, for example, is that the ground in those places has just been dug up, filled in, and dug up again over and over and over. There's years and years worth of wood and debris from old shafts, tunnels, pumps, floods, and on, all down there in the dirt. And thus it becomes next to impossible to figure out what it really is you're looking at when you bring something up. That is definitively not the case in the Swamp. Fred Nolan did try and drain it and search a couple of times, as did the Laginas in earlier seasons of The Curse of Oak Island. But those attempts really didn't get too far compared to this, and certainly didn't leave behind anything that would get in the way of what they're doing now. So what we are getting here is a look at what I would kind of refer to as the real Oak Island, the one that existed before the bulldozers and backhoes turned it into a very different place than even it was in the late 18th century. So when experts are saying they're looking at something that is old and man-made in this area, we know for certain it is not searcher-related. The work in this episode at the Swamp begins at the crazy area of giant boulders the team uncovered a couple episodes back. This is in what they're calling the Eye of the Swamp. And as usual, just saying that phrase seems to be nothing more than an excuse for the narrator to launch into Templar/Freemason/add-your-silliness here soliloquy. I think during this latest exaggerated meltdown, the narrator even said something like, quote, the team refers to the area now as the all-seeing eye. But is that really true? Does Marty Lagina really think the Swamp was designed specifically to be a giant representation of the all-seeing eye? Or was he just kind of making a joke as he was talking there? That's what it seemed like to me, at least. So what exactly is the all-seeing eye? I don't mean the area of the Swamp here that I'm talking about. I mean the symbology the narrator is constantly referring to. If you want to get a good look at what I'm talking about here, go to your wallet and grab a dollar bill. Turn to the back, the side without George Washington, and you'll see a pyramid on the left. The top portion of that pyramid is floating over the rest of the body of the pyramid, creating sort of a small triangle itself. This small pyramid, this small triangle, has an eye in the middle of it with rays of light bursting out in all directions. This is what we refer to as the all-seeing eye, also known down in history as the Eye of Providence. The roots of the eye go all the way back to the ancient Egyptians, where we find very similar symbols in that culture, including things like the Eye of Horus or the Eye of Ra. Ra and Horus were both Egyptian deities and or gods, if you will. And without getting too far into the allegories behind the symbols and their creation, because they really are very different from each other, and I don't want to get too far into that. Basically, both symbols stand sort of for these gods watching over us mere mortals. The Christian symbol, which comes later in, down in history, was called the Eye of Providence and embodies essentially that same idea. It stands for the Eye of God watching over the world, or whoever needs to be watched over, I guess, in the story behind wherever it's used. Most scholars agree the first Christian use of the symbol can be found in the 1525 painting called The Last Supper at Emmaus by the Italian Renaissance painter named Pontormo. The painting depicts the resurrected Jesus sitting at a table holding bread, revealing himself, his resurrected self, to his disciples. And above it all, the eye of God, the all-seeing eye, is watching over the scene, and the eye is depicted within a triangle, which represents the Holy Trinity. In later years, the eye was adopted by many different organizations, especially religious ones, who use the eye as a reminder for the members of this organization to conduct themselves in a manner as if God were watching them. One such organization was the Freemasons. And wherever there are Freemasons, there are conspiracy theories. One such conspiracy, just as an example, really, basically says that the Freemasons created the United States themselves, really, and the all-seeing eye appearing on the dollar bill and also on the Great Seal of the United States is proof of that. You see this in things like National Treasure and so many other places. Make of it what you will, but you get the point of what I'm going here. With many conspiracy theories where there is a possible all-seeing eye involved, there seems to be Freemasons. And where there are Freemasons, for some reason, there seems to be Templars. I guess the only thing I'll say about Freemasons and Templars, once again, is they are not the same thing. I've said this many, many times before. And the all-seeing eye is used in literally thousands of places by many artists and many organizations throughout history all over the place. All over, really, the Christian world, to be honest. And many of those places have absolutely nothing to do with Freemasonry. Anyway, I digress. Just a little context for what the all-seeing eye is beyond just the couple of sentences you get from the narrator. The swamp doctor, Dr. Ian Spooner of Acadia University, is on the scene again to get a look at these huge boulders. And once again, he's blown away by what he sees. Also, the raised mercury and lead levels in the area are something he really can't seem to explain. And he finds the mercury, I think he called it weird or something like that, like exceptionally weird. Now, mercury is a rare but naturally occurring element. Keep that in mind. It was discovered in South America, I think, and ages ago. And nowadays, it's mined mostly in China, I believe. But it's found all over the world. It's been used for centuries in all sorts of applications. You know, now medical, some decorative, you name it. It's got a lot of applications. And as I've mentioned in the past, even though it does sort of correlate somehow with the whole Francis Bacon theory, it does not by any means mean that that's the only possibility of why there might be mercury here. Okay, so just kind of keep that in mind. Now, even though it's certainly natural to find it in the ground, someone like the swamp doctor would immediately recognize if the levels he's finding here are indeed unusual for that area. So let's take him at his word. He is the guy to ask. Now, later in the episode, Dr. Spooner brings in a colleague from Acadia University, an archaeologist named Aaron Taylor. Here, the two experts are getting a better look at this paved area we've been talking about for weeks to see if it connects somehow with what they are finding here now in the eye. And in this scene, the editors finally give us a really good look at the makeup of this so-called paved area, a nice kind of cross-section photo. I'll try and get a screenshot for the Facebook page if I can. But I'll say this. I think I'm convinced now. This is without doubt weird and really doesn't look natural, even to an untrained eye like myself. Taylor, the archaeologist, is also shocked by all this. saying the area is certainly, quote, not 10,000 years old, meaning these rocks were not deposited here by ancient glacial movements during the last ice age. The inference there is that this must then therefore be man-made or man-manipulated in some way. But then, finally and fascinatingly, we have a theory as to what this might really be. It seems that Spooner and Taylor, these two experts, are now concluding that, quote, the eye was excavated to extract clay. Essentially, the eye was used as a clay mine or a quarry. Now, clay obviously has been in use for thousands and thousands of years. And everything from pottery and sculptures, you know, musical instruments, as well as for bricks and cement and other building applications, thousands and thousands of years. And to add to that, Spooner and Taylor also think the most obvious conclusion here is that the paved area was most likely constructed to help in the process of extracting and removing the clay out of the mine. If the ground was soft back then, think about it. If the ground was soft back then, it would be impossible to get horses and carts and that kind of thing in and out of the area. So hence, the building of the paving stones. Now, this is without doubt a fascinating theory and a logical one and one of the best ones I've heard so far. The problem is that this theory doesn't really help us at all in trying to find when this mine might have been dug and by whom. It could have been at any point in history, really, if you think about it. If research concludes that it was not done by local landowners and European settlers, and that's pretty easy to figure out, then the obvious next choice, and maybe the best choice of all, is the local First Nations people, the Mi'kmaq tribe. Like everyone else in the world, not just, you know, First Nations, the Mi'kmaq certainly used clay for cooking and pottery and all that kind of stuff, for art and all that kind of stuff. They had to get the clay from somewhere, so why not here on Oak Island? In my mind, the logical thing for the team to do now is to go down that road of thinking. Is there a way to see if any of the locally, found or sourced Mi'kmaq artifacts, pottery, clay artifacts, do they somehow match up with the clay we're finding here in the swamp? I don't know if that's even possible to find out, but if the answer is yes, then we can at least conclude that the swamp is indeed strange and certainly manipulated centuries ago by man, but it was not done by the Templars or Francis Bacon or whoever you might think might have been responsible. Now, my guess is, and I don't want to sound snarky here, but my guess is that we won't be seeing any of that kind of research on the show to see if this is really something created by the local Mi'kmaq tribe. And then therefore, it could be, that could serve to kind of put an X through the swamp to say this is not something related to the money pit. It doesn't displace the money pit as a mystery. It just means it's not related. A clay quarry made by local native people, unfortunately, is not anywhere near as sexy as a clandestine voyage of the Knights Templar to hide the Ark of the Covenant. Now, here's hoping I'm wrong. Later in the episode, the team starts digging in another area just off this paved area to see how far it extends. They find some more of the rocks that, these little paving rocks that might match up a little bit. But as they're doing this, water starts pouring in from all around. And I mean pouring in. And here is where we get the old Rick Lagina back in full form, folks. He instructs Billy Gerhardt to pull up an excavator bucket full of this thick, brown, probably putrid-smelling water. He then grabs an old, used plastic bottle from off the floor in the excavator, I think, and fills it with this muck and has a drink. My God. Anyway, through the dirt and the filth of all this, he tastes salt. So, is this seawater from a natural source, or is this part of the flood system? Interesting question. We shall see. Either way, the swamp doctor thinks this new area they're looking at here matches pretty well with what they see in the paved area already. So perhaps we can follow it to find out the real scope and of how big this whole paved section truly is and where it extends. I'm not really sure what that's going to tell us in the long run, but let's wait and see. So So that's going to do it for another episode of Digging Oak Island. Just a reminder, I do have another podcast. It's called Sit Downs and Sessions. My friend and radio host Chris Poe and I sit down with a couple of beers and talk about pubs, politics, paranormal stuff, all that kind of thing. And this week we actually talk about UFOs, as Chris really is a lifelong expert on this subject. You can find that show, Sit Downs and Sessions, on iTunes and all the usual places. Just search there. Also, please give us a 5-star rating for Digging Oak Island here on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. It helps to get the word out on the show. Also, my sincere thanks to everyone who has left us a 5-star rating already. I really do appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time to do that. And especially thank you for the kind words. Don't forget, you can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Digging Oak Island. And again, if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email. It's the best way, diggingoakisland@gmail.com. And just keep in mind, I say this all the time, if you send me an email, or even if you direct message me on social media, keep in mind that I may just answer the questions or the comments you give me here on this podcast. So if you don't want your message read, just please make a note of that for me, and I'll just answer you through whatever method you contacted me. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.